Although Nolan had been living in the studio for weeks, he'd had no idea that his predecessor there had been the illustrious suicide until Carl, the residency manager, mentioned it to him one afternoon when he came by to oversee the semi-monthly maintenance work that was done on the property and its grounds. Alexander Mulligan III had not signed the guest book in which previous residents had entered their names. He had not left behind anything of himself, no trace of his presence or of the tortured psyche that had led him one afternoon while his wife and two daughters were visiting friends to slit his wrists in a warm tub after nailing the bathroom door shut and throwing both the hammer and his cell phone out of the bathroom window as if to guarantee his resolve in the event of a sudden change of heart. Nolan had not been particularly interested in Mulligan's work, but the novelist's sad story made an enormous impression on him. Mulligan had left his wife and daughters for a married woman who, a few months later, broke things off with him to repair her marriage after discovering that she'd become pregnant with her husband's baby while Mulligan was away on a magazine assignment. Mulligan had gone back to his wife, but eventually she'd thrown him out of the house, and he'd then drifted for a while, defaulting on a large book contract in the process. At the time of his self-murder, he was indigent, and his now ex-wife had taken him in out of pity. He'd slept on the couch in his old apartment. One afternoon, while Nolan considered Mulligan's case, as he thought of it, during one of his regular walks, he wondered whether his having learned of Mulligan's occupancy had turned him against suicide or helped him decide in favor of it. He supposed he didn't quite know what he could hope to accomplish through suicide. Nolan already felt non-existent. He'd felt that way before he felt cursed. When he got up, he would dress himself in what he'd worn the day before. Sometimes he would shower and shave and put on clean clothes before the end of the day, but often not. He ignored the phone and refused to listen to his messages. Emails piled up unread. He'd bought some furniture, reshelved his books to fill the gaps that his girlfriend's departure had left, read until his eyes stung, took his walks. So this was the young manhood he'd sometimes yearned for while he'd been buried in domesticity, a life of reading alone in badly furnished rooms, inching toward a ridiculous PhD. He hadn't remembered the lonely boredom, and once he'd recognized it, it occurred to him that what had been essential at 25 struck him as stupid in middle age. It was this, more than anything else, his habit of sitting for most of the day and night, unbathed and in soiled clothes, bent over a book, that lent texture to his feeling of dissatisfaction. For the first time in almost 20 years since he'd met his ex-wife, he was unaccountable to anyone. His tests of this lack of accountability invariably depressed him. If he returned home late, or drunk, or both, it wasn't freedom, he felt, but only that no one cared. Despite the chafing of the responsibilities that had contributed to his leaving his wife, they had tied him to a recognizable and substantive self that existed in the regard of others. Underemployment and its gradual stripping away of duties and obligations outside the house had hurt his ego and made him feel insignificant, but to return to an empty apartment made him feel non-existent. Any sense of relief that he felt on returning home vanished after he closed and locked the door behind him, turning on the lights to be greeted by whatever scene had sat unchanged in his absence, awaiting his return to mock him. More and more often, he imagined himself dead on the floor. Arizona had prepared him for it, an exaggerated state of solitude. 3 hours from the nearest airport, sun hanging in an enormous sky until 10 at night. But Nolan hadn't intended to be fooled by the desert spaces. He felt not privileged, not convenienced, but intelligent to be living in an era of collapsed distances. A time when remoteness could only be experienced through deliberate self-removal, an exercise of the will. They'd informed him that he'd been selected to go, and he went, not intending to be fooled. He had his misgivings. Space and isolation had never seemed like prerequisites for working well to Nolan. He could not imagine a neurosurgeon needing to withdraw to the Mojave in order to cut into a living brain, a distant passing truck raising clouds of dust. Could not imagine a general requiring a remote cabin to grapple amid birdsong and the drone of insects with military strategy. But Nolan had done it anyway, for his career. He was given a nice studio that looked like a Hollywood bureaucrat's dream of a writer's retreat, to place a man who'd made his money in software, some accidental tycoon with his heart stuck in the humanities, would have built to write the novel long congealed within his wealthy and thwarted soul. Nolan was practically afraid to sit on half the furniture. An octet of Agnes Martin prints on the wall. The same, again, the same, again, the same, again, the same, again. The light hit the prints in shifting stages each afternoon. Each hour brought a different look to them. No, the desert spaces hadn't fooled Nolan. They'd simply asserted themselves with nature's candor. He may have had a cellular telephone set to the nation's official atomic clock, but the markers of time here were the most primitive, diurnal, clouds massing above the mountains and moving in each afternoon, thunder beyond the furrowed ridges, sunlight tracking the wall, those prints. Had Mulligan noticed also the way those sketchy, fretful lines had flared and faded when the sky changed? As the world turned. Had the studio too been cursed? Could curses compound? Had Constance's curse guided Nolan first to that desolate place and then to the single location among six studios scattered there, where a suicide had spent a few weeks learning to be beside the point? But Mulligan had been different. Mulligan's fate hadn't been in the hands of a vindictive individual. It had been a matter of chemistry colliding with circumstance. Nolan became envious of the dead writer. In newspapers, magazines, and all over the internet, people wrote of Mulligan. Tributes to his humanity, his humility, his sense of humor, his helpfulness, his aim to connect with the hearts of his characters and his readers. Students, colleagues, friends, relatives, people who'd met him once at a party, all wrote, apparently wherever the opportunity presented itself, of the dead man's humane decency, surpassing in its abundant quantity and transcendent quality. Could it really be, Nolan wondered? Wasn't there one undergraduate toward whom Mulligan hadn't been able to conceal his boredom and or contempt? One supplicant whose letter to Mulligan went unanswered? One organizer of a literary festival whom Mulligan had brusquely turned down? One author whose book Mulligan had panned? Mulligan had gotten through an entire career without once pissing anyone off? There wasn't one person who was happy Mulligan was dead? Nolan had enemies all over the place, he was certain. He'd failed students, cut colleagues off at the knees on panels, named names in his essays and articles, chopped books he was reviewing into cat meat. It seemed like the only reason to become a critic to begin with. I am right and you are not. This is beautiful, that is ugly, and you are either ignorant or corrupt if you claim otherwise. Working to convince people by any rhetorical means that he was right to save their souls, let alone to make them feel good, seemed completely beside the point. Unless it was possible that he, individually and alone, was doggedly working against the grain of the age. Suicide. The backlog of phone messages and emails continued to grow as Nolan read Alexander Mulligan for the first time, with care, finding premonitory references to the author's demise embedded, like large and projecting boulders, throughout the novel's essays and stories. It was as if Mulligan had been planning the whole thing from the moment he'd started publishing. Going over his own output in his mind, Nolan took pride in his subtlety. He was certain that after he himself had committed suicide, his future biographers would have to work very hard to find any foreshadowing of it in his work. Anything he'd written that was tinted by the various shadings of depression and despair he'd experienced was far subtler than anything of Mulligan's. But Mulligan had beaten the rap somehow. When Nolan himself died, who'd even show up? Where would they even sit? How would they manage all the factions Nolan had created with his disastrous management of his personal life? Instead of the unanimous silence, broken only by a few audible sobs of mournful admiration in a crowded public space, he imagined laughter, sniping, and, worst of all, the bored shuffling of feet that became discernible at readings and other tedious events. Fuck them, he thought. He'd keep on living. Thank you very much.